and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an examination of the Russian media's coverage of Donald Trump, who is routinely referred to on state TV as, quote, our president, with a political joke doing the rounds on Kremlin-controlled state TV that Republican congressmen are visiting Russia, quote, to make deals with our hackers so they can rig the midterms in favor of Trump's team. Julia Davis, the founder and editor of Russian Media Monitor, which analyzes Russian media and the relationship between news and propaganda, joins us to discuss a recent broadcast of Russia's 60 Minutes news program in which a pundit implied Putin has leverage over Trump and that America's president should stop the U.S. sanctions, which incidentally Trump is delaying and undermining. Otherwise, quote, if you want us to support you in the election, do what we say. We will also examine the irony that while Trump uses Stalin's term enemy of the people to describe the press that's not Fox News, Russian media has the same list of enemies as Trump does, Democrats, the deep state, and the U.S. media. Then we'll speak with John Boniface, the co-founder and president of Free Speech for People, who previously served as executive director and general counsel of the National Voting Rights Institute and as legal director of Voter Action. He joins us to discuss his new book, The Constitution Demands It, The Case for the Impeachment of Donald Trump. And we will assess whether Trump has been violating the Constitution from the moment he took the oath of office and examine the eight categories in which Trump has already crossed the line into impeachable territory. Then finally, we will look into a shocking report just issued from a grand jury investigation in Pennsylvania, revealing that the Catholic Church in the state covered up child sex abuse by 301 priests over a 70-year period, with the report identifying over 1,000 victims. Kenneth Briggs, who writes for the National Catholic Reporter and was a religion editor for the New York Times, joins us to discuss the continuing scandal that dogs the church and mires the Pope in periodic purges of church leaders around the world in Chile, Australia, and now in Pennsylvania. And joining us now, Julia Davis, the founder and editor of Russian Media Monitor, which analyzes Russia's media and the relationship between news and propaganda. A former federal officer, she served with the Department of Homeland Security, Customs and Border Protection as an acting supervisor and is a featured expert with the Atlantic Council's disinformation portal. Welcome to Background Briefing, Julia Davis.
Thank you so much for having me.
And Julia, there was an extraordinary admission, if you will, on Russian TV recently on their 60 Minutes program, where they more or less, one of the sort of talking heads, basically implied that Russia holds something over Trump and that they should use that leverage to bend Trump to their will. And this was in the context of this new round of sanctions. And according to the translation, and I believe it's your translation, one of these, a dean at Moscow State University said, if you want us to support you, talking about Trump, if you want us to support you in the elections, do what we say. So regularly on Russian media, they've referred to Trump as our president. And they even joke about there's a joke going around, U.S. lawmakers travel to Russia to make deals with our hackers so they can rig the midterms in favor of Trump's team. Where does this stand in terms of truth? Is this people just, obviously you don't believe everything you see on our media, particularly on Fox, so you certainly can't believe everything you see on Russian media. But where do you think the line is here between irony and truth?
Well, with Russian media, well, you certainly have to take it with a not only a pinch of salt, but a pound of salt, because they are known to lie and exaggerate. But when you look at how it comports with Trump's own actions and his apparent subservience to Putin, his behavior during the Helsinki conference and his statements thereafter, you definitely might come to the conclusion that there is something to it. And in the Russian state media, there is one thing that has been a constant since the time Trump was elected is that their firm belief that he will at some point come through and pay off for Russia. So it is reasonable to assume that they are holding some sort of evidence that they believe could prompt Trump to act in their interest.
So do you think that there is something to that threat? That, in other words, the implication here is that Putin and Trump made a deal, perhaps at Helsinki, that Putin would help him out in the 2018 midterms coming up in November. He clearly helped Trump out in 2016. There's no doubt about that. Do you think there's something to that threat that was made on the Russian TV show 60 Minutes?
I think there could be. And, you know, there recently was a DEFCON hacking conference, and they talked about how easy it is to physically gain administrative access on voting machines that is used in 18 states, and it requires no tools. So there are legitimate concerns, and Russia certainly is capable of interfering and have shown themselves being willing to do whatever it takes. And they have been talking on state television about midterms, and that the Republican Party is in trouble and could suffer significant losses in the midterms. So if they feel like it suits their agenda, I certainly think there's something to those threats. Also, Trump, in signing even a defense bill today, he complained about the provisions related to Russia and said that even though he's signing the bill, he might choose to ignore those provisions, and that it's the same thing the Russians are counting on with respect to the sanctions, that even though they might be signed into law, Trump might elect to sabotage their implementation, and in exchange, they would help him with midterms, and there's no telling what else is going on behind the scenes. But even our top intelligence officials are still not completely sure what exactly happened in Helsinki. So there's much happening behind the scenes.
It's extraordinary, I find, Julia Davis, that nobody's been able to get Trump to explain why he keeps rolling over for Putin, and particularly why he slow walks these sanctions, and why in the new defense authorization bill, the McCain bill, which of course he didn't use John McCain's name, that he's saying that he's also not going to, or he doesn't want to implement the sanctions against Russia. Has anybody, to your knowledge, ever asked him why? Why are you doing this?
There is a firm belief amongst the Russians that there is some sort of material that exists that is prompting Trump to act the way he is. And really, it's very difficult to imagine any other kind of an explanation when we're dealing with a self-proclaimed sworn enemy of the United States like Russia that means us harm.
So you're talking about compromise.
Yes, and they like to hint on Russian state media as well that they have known Trump since the 80s. And to me, that says that obviously he was being watched way back when, before anyone knew he would ever run for president. And that is not anything unusual. Putin made it sound like it would be something extraordinary for Trump to be watched just as a wealthy businessman. But in fact, any foreigner traveling to Russia will be watched and recorded, and it doesn't have to be a person of particular significance. That's just the way they operate. They collect a lot of intelligence, and it's a system of total surveillance, especially with respect to foreigners. So there are great chances that they are in possession of some sort of incriminating material.
Well, of course, one of the great ironies about Russian media is the way they cast the enemies. You know, Donald Trump talks about the press here being the enemy of the state, because that's a term that goes back to Stalin. But in terms of the way Russian media portrays the enemies on Russian state TV, they are one, the Democrats, two, the deep state, and three, the U.S. media. Well, isn't that a coincidence? That's exactly the enemies of Donald Trump, right?
Exactly, and they also like to use the same exact terms that he does, like witch hunt. And when they talk about the United States as a whole, they consider our entire country as their arch nemesis and the enemy, but they talk about Trump as their guy in the enemy camp, and that is very troubling.
So is this because of the KGB mindset, Glavny Protivnik, the idea that the main enemy that was drilled into KGB officers, or how has it become? Because I don't believe the young Russians feel this way, do, at least the educated urban ones. I mean, give me a sense, since you study the Russian media, how much this idea of the America being the main enemy is pervasive. Because one of the things I had heard was that there's a certain irony that's backfired on Putin, because the Russian people think Putin is so clever that he controls the American president, and therefore we don't have to worry about the Americans because we have the guy at the top under our thumb, and he's the guy with his finger on the nuclear button.
Yes, it's very interesting that the mindset seems to be similar to the Soviet mindset, where the West was the enemy, but today it seems to be for a different reason. When we're talking about modern Russia, we're talking about Putin's Russia. And therefore, the enemy is anyone that stands in the way of Putin's interests, which is indefinite power, indefinite term that he could stay in office, and the restoration of Russia's control over the post-Soviet space. And also dominance in the Middle East. And he sees Trump as a tool that he could use to get that influence back, to get that control back, and to continue his reign unchecked. And he takes it very personally when the establishment and other executive branches of the government stand in Trump's way, while he believes Trump would willingly hand him those keys to the kingdom that he wants. And the West, as a democracy, an entire organism that promotes the idea of democracy, is something that Putin deeply resents, because he could not maintain his grip on society if Russia truly was a democracy. So that is certainly not what he wants, and for that reason alone, he is striving to break down the transatlantic unity and to undermine the West in every way he can, so that he could show that the idea of democracy does not work. And the Russians, for decades now on their state television, have been openly hoping that the U.S. will fall into another Great Depression, that the dollar will collapse, that our entire system will be in turmoil and chaos. And Putin is doing anything in his power to try to bring that into reality, while it should not happen. And, you know, I don't believe that it would ever go that far, but that's certainly their goal.
Well, but Donald Trump seems to be helping him in all of the aims that Putin has that you outlined, Julia Davis. Trump supported Brexit. Trump has undermined the EU. Trump has undermined NATO. He's attacked our closest allies, the UK and Germany, personally attacked their leaders. He's never guaranteed Article 5. He's apparently willing to basically sell out American interests in Syria at any moment. And just today, because there's the U.S. and Turkey, a NATO ally, are at loggerheads, Lavrov, Russia's foreign minister, said today, talking about how ties between U.S. and Turkey, a NATO ally, are fraying, whereas ties between Russia and Turkey are improving. Lavrov said today, "We are at a turning point, without exaggeration, in world history, from the dominance by a single power towards a multipolar environment. So there you have it. He's basically saying America's on the way out, and there are going to be other players on the world stage and not just the U.S. dominating the globe. So how much does Russian media make the connection that Trump appears to be helping Putin at every turn?
They make that connection repeatedly, and they sum up all of the above, everything that you had just mentioned, to say that Trump is achieving all of Putin's aims. All that Putin has to do is just sit back and watch Trump shatter the European Union, NATO, break up ties with our main allies, and achieve the sort of a rift and transatlantic unity that the Soviet Union have been trying to create for decades and has failed, and now Trump is achieving it for Putin.
So you're left with the puzzlement of what's going on with the Republicans then. I mean, the Republican Party used to be the party of red baiters and Soviet haters, and now, along with Trump, they are making excuses for Putin. And they're sticking with Trump, although with some notable exceptions like Senator McCain and Senator Lindsey Graham. But by and large, what would your explanation be for it? Why are the Republicans enabling Trump in what appears to be treasonous behavior?
It seems to me that they're doing it for motives that are more personal than anything else, thinking about their positions, their careers, first and foremost, and placing all that above the interests of the country. And history will not judge them kindly. What we're witnessing is a craven party that is willing to accept and tolerate even treasonous behavior.
So you've got this peculiar behavior of the Republicans on the right now basically making excuses for Putin and going along with what appears to be treasonous behavior on the part of Trump. What explains on the political left in this country? The Nation magazine, the editors of that keep making excuses for Putin. Oliver Stone made that ridiculous Valentine to Putin for Showtime. You know, if you really had any political and ideological consistency on the political left, you would be in solidarity with the young Russian college and high school kids that are out on the streets demonstrating, getting beaten up by Putin's goons. You know, they're the future of Russia. They're the ones who are having their future stolen by this kleptocracy of the Siloviki. So why do the American left, people like Jill Stein and others, Oliver Stone, The Nation magazine, why do they support Putin? Because he's a capitalist thug, is he not? A kleptocrat.
He absolutely is. And also people like Rand Paul, who professes to be a libertarian, who is so deeply entrenched now with defending Russian behavior and defending Putin. And I think it comes down to Russia's willingness to cultivate supporters from either side of the political spectrum, because they really like and support none of us, and they don't care whether someone is from the far right or from the far left. If they can find an approach to them, they will. And, you know, people like Jill Stein, for example, they like to pick people from the political fringe that probably feel like they're not getting enough exposure in the American media. And the Russian state media gives them that opportunity and secures their loyalty. And that is one of the means that they use. And who's to say that there aren't other means that are happening behind the scenes?
Well, just in closing, back to the possibility that Putin and Trump, that meeting in Helsinki with no record and just like two mafia bosses meeting in a secret location so that the FBI couldn't wiretap them, that was the optics. So we don't know whether there was a record. I'm assuming that Russian intelligence has a record. Whether the U.S. CIA were able to get a recording, that would have gone against the commander-in-chief if they did it. So do you think that a deal was done or could have been done to basically rig the elections in November so that the Democratic blue wave will disappear through cyber meddling by Russia and there'll be complete chaos in this country, making what happened in Florida 2000 look like a minor hiccup?
I think that the meeting in Helsinki was mainly for optics. I'm sure that there are probably back channels and other ways of communication where deals like that would be made, because there'd be a full expectation that someone is recording that meeting in its entirety. Certainly the Russians and hopefully the U.S. did as well. So I think it was more just to reinforce Trump's undying devotion to Putin, which he also expressed in the following press conference. So it was pretty obvious if he was that subservient in the press conference, you can only imagine what happened behind closed doors. So I think it was more to reinforce that relationship between them, and whatever deals are being made, I'm sure they're happening behind the scenes, and it's very likely that there are some agreements that are quietly being made without the public ever finding out.
So you think they will screw with the elections?
I think it's possible. I think it's a real possibility.
Well, Julia Davis, I thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me again.
And again, I've been speaking with Julia Davis, who's the founder and editor of Russian Media Monitor, which analyzes Russia's media and the relationship between news and propaganda. A former federal officer, she served with the Department of Homeland Security, Customs and Border Protection as an acting supervisor, and is a featured expert with the Atlantic Council's disinformation portal. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back discussing a new book, The Constitution Demands It, The Case for the Impeachment of Donald Trump. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is John Boniface, who is the co-founder and president of Free Speech for People, who previously served as the executive director and general counsel of the National Voting Rights Institute and as the legal director of Voter Action. A distinguished attorney, he has been at the forefront of key voting rights battles across the country for more than two decades and is a winner of a McCarthy Foundation Fellowship Award. And he's the co-author of the new book, Just Out, The Constitution Demands It, The Case for the Impeachment of Donald Trump. Welcome to Background Briefing, John Boniface.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, John, amongst the sort of punditry, and indeed amongst the leadership in the Democratic Party, Nancy Pelosi and others, what we're hearing is that impeachment is a terribly bad idea, particularly to run on as we approach the November elections, and that essentially plays right into Donald Trump's hands, as people have also argued that the call to abolish ICE plays into Trump's hands. So how do you answer that, given the title of your new book?
Yes, the way we answer this is that we are already in the middle of a constitutional crisis, and that constitutional crisis has been created by a president who's been willfully violating the Constitution and the rule of law from the moment he took the oath of office. So we cannot be placing party over country in the middle of this crisis. We must proceed now with pressing for impeachment proceedings against this president and upholding that fundamental principle that no one is above the law, not even the President of the United States. And what we've laid out in this book are 8 legal grounds for impeachment proceedings to move forward now. Many want to look at the Robert Mueller, special counsel Robert Mueller investigation as the means by which, the question is determined whether such impeachment proceedings should begin. But that is really apples and oranges. Robert Mueller is engaged in a criminal investigation of whether or not Donald Trump or any of his associates have committed crimes and violations of the federal code, federal criminal law. That is a separate, distinct question from whether or not this president has committed crimes against the state, abuse of power, abuse of the public trust, and that's what we've laid out in this book.
Well, there is a great deal of concern that, and it was expressed on yesterday's program by an expert on the White House's operations. He's written a book which involved interviewing all 18 former chiefs of staff, and he brought it up that he thinks that Trump's current little spat with Omarosa is a sort of distraction and that, in effect, we have government by stunt and by distraction on a daily basis, and that what we should be focusing on is what went on in that secret meeting between Trump and Putin in Helsinki. And frankly, some of the reports I'm hearing from the Russian media, some of the Russian state media pundits are more or less saying, well, we have something over Trump. We should use our leverage, and we won't help him in the 2018 elections unless he gets rid of the sanctions. That's the kind of level of the political dialogue that's going on in Russia. So it's not inconceivable to my mind that election meddling, as we've been told by all of the heads of the various intelligence agencies that are involved, like Homeland Security, NSA, FBI, etc. They recently met and said the Russians are meddling again. Could it be that Trump and Putin made a deal? Trump doesn't want to be impeached. He doesn't want the Democrats to take over the House. What's to stop the Russians from really screwing with the next election?
Well, I think that's a serious concern, absolutely. And I think everything should be done by those in Congress and those who have oversight over the executive branch to engage in determining how our elections can be further protected. One of the biggest problems that we have in this country is that we do not properly verify our elections in most states after they occur. That means that we don't look at the ballots. We don't randomly audit the process. We simply trust the machine tallies, whether they're electronic voting machines, which there is no paper record, which are defective machines for using for tabulating votes, or whether they're optical scan devices where you scan your paper ballot that you've hand-marked and put it through the machine. When those ballots are not looked at, that is, I think, a serious concern with respect to the verification process. But all that being said, I don't think that while we shouldn't be ignoring the concern around the upcoming election, it doesn't change the fact that we already have a president who's engaged in these abuses of power and abuse of the public trust, including the conspiracy to coordinate with a foreign government to violate federal campaign finance laws, which we identify in the book as an impeachable offense. So I think we should be doing both. I think we should be focusing on how we protect the upcoming election from interference by a foreign entity in coordination potentially with the Oval Office, but also we should be focused on how we deal with this threat to democracy, this threat to our Constitution coming directly out of the Oval Office right now.
But it's not just Donald Trump. The Republican Party, and particularly the leaders in the House and Senate, are in complete collusion with Donald Trump. In fact, the Tea Party wing of the House are actively trying to scuttle the Mueller investigation by ginning up this phony impeachment case against Rod Rosenstein. And the president has almost obsessively been tweeting out about, you know, no collusion, witch hunt, all of this crazy stuff that indicates that Trump himself is like one step ahead of the sheriff and extremely nervous about what they're going to find out about him or what they probably already found out about him. But again, he's not on his own. He's being protected by the Republicans. So what's their calculus? Why do you think they're doing what they're doing? Why are they not being patriots?
Well, I think some of them believe that the agenda that they want to promote in the United States Congress matches the president's agenda to some extent, and they want to, again, put party over country. They want to see that agenda put forward regardless of whether a lawless president is engaged in putting it forward. But I think we also have to remember that during the Watergate era, then-President Richard Nixon had his supporters in Congress, and in fact he had 30% public support in the polls the day he was forced to resign. So it's not as if there aren't going to be those who blindly follow this president either in Congress or among the public. But the vast majority of us who care about democracy, who care about our Constitution from a nonpartisan perspective, need to put pressure on all members of Congress, all elected officials, to uphold the oath they have taken to defend, protect, and preserve the Constitution in the midst of this constitutional crisis. You know, John Nichols, the national affairs correspondent for The Nation, wrote the foreword to this book, and he speaks about impeachment is not a constitutional crisis. Impeachment is the cure for a constitutional crisis, and that is exactly right. And that is why we need to lay the groundwork now for these impeachment proceedings. We recognize they're not going to happen tomorrow. They're not going to start happening tomorrow in the Congress, but we need to lay the groundwork for why this president needs to be held accountable. And the framers understood that the purpose of the impeachment provision was not for punishment. That's for the criminal laws to address. That's what Robert Mueller's focused on. The impeachment process is to protect the republic, to protect our Constitution, to ensure that someone in office, in this case, someone in the Oval Office, who's engaged in attacking society itself and attacking our Constitution, need to be removed to ensure that we protect our body politic.
But when you mentioned Watergate, John Boniface, and how one-third of Americans still supported Richard Nixon even on when he resigned, and it's around 35% for Trump, and they are pretty locked in and pretty impermeable to information, facts, and evidence. So they will stick by him. But the difference was that the Watergate hearing was all in public. The whole country saw it unfold before their eyes, whereas we don't know what's going on with Robert Mueller. It's all being done in secret. And, of course, Trump and Giuliani and the White House and the Republicans have an advantage because they can demagogue in the absence of Mueller being able to correct the record. So that's the situation we're in. How do you, if you want to impeach this guy, how do you make a case? I mean, you've made a case in the book, there's no question about it, but how do you get it to the public in the way that the Watergate hearing unfolded before the nation's eyes?
Well, of course, we have to remember, right, that Richard Nixon won re-election in 1972 in a landslide election against then Senator George McGovern, and Watergate hearing started after that re-election. He was at a very high approval rating when you know, he was re-elected, and yet Congress found that it had to, because of all the investigative reporting that was going on from the Washington Post, Woodward and Bernstein, New York Times, and elsewhere, that ultimately they had to delve into further the Watergate affair, and that led beyond the Senate Watergate hearings. It led to impeachment proceedings in May of 1974. And we're not even there yet, right? We have not even had any start of, as you point out, public hearings, impeachment hearings, and yet we already have nearly 50% of the public endorsing the idea of impeachment proceedings. So we can only imagine that were we to have those kinds of public proceedings, that public support would grow further. You're correct that the special counsel investigation is proceeding in secret, as it should, as a criminal investigation should, only when there are indictments or public actions to be taken by the special prosecutor should we learn of them. But that is, again, a different investigation than what we're talking about. That is a criminal investigation. This is an impeachment investigation that we're seeking. And we as a people, regardless of our position, you know, in the country, whether we're elected officials or whether we're ordinary citizens, we have a role to play in ensuring that we uphold our Constitution and our democracy. 17 communities, including the city of Los Angeles, have already voted for resolutions calling for impeachment proceedings. And we think that should happen more and more in places around the country. And people can be very engaged. And we talk in the book about how people can become involved in standing up for our Constitution at this critical moment in our history.
Well, let me make the case that others are making against impeachment for tactical and strategic reasons in terms of the midterms. The biggest voting bloc in this country now are independents. And I think Democrats are the second biggest, and then Republicans are the third. The Democrats, in order to take over the House and even possibly the Senate, they have to win over, first of all, they've got to get their own people out. And in the last midterm, only one third of registered Democrats voted. So that's a challenge to get people out. Number two, if you're trying to win over, you know, purple and red states, you've got to win over the independents. And the argument is that if you're saying the minute we get control of the House, we're going to impeach Trump, to a lot of people that means that there's going to be these trials and this government paralysis, and we're not going to deal with the real issues facing this country, particularly given the looting and destruction that's gone on with Trump. So that's the sort of the argument that you hear, and that what makes more sense is to run on the platform of not impeaching Trump, but stopping him, just stopping the damage he's doing, because you can basically make the case, and it's very clear, that the Founding Fathers thought in terms of setting up this separation of powers that the House would be a check and balance against the executive branch. Well, that the Congress would be a check and balance against the executive branch. Of course, the Republicans, in their craven abdication of their patriotic duty, are allowing Trump to run roughshod over the Constitution. So isn't that a strong argument, or if perhaps even a stronger argument than the impeachment argument, that we just got to take over the House to stop this guy because the Republicans aren't doing their job?
We don't look at it that way. We look at it from a constitutional perspective. This is not a book written, and our arguments are not made from the perspective of any particular political persuasion. The question before us and that we present in this book is, what is at stake with respect to our Constitution and our democracy and the state of the rule of law? And when we look at that question, we see a series of impeachable offenses that have already been committed by this president and for which he must be held accountable. Now, I'm sure many listeners might say, well, how are you going to do that under the current Congress? And we accept that that hasn't happened yet. But we need to lay the groundwork for the moment when there will be the political support for this. I think it's a mistake to assume that people in the country who hear the message of standing up for the Constitution, standing up for democracy, regardless of whether they ascribe themselves to be Democrats, Republicans, Independents, that the bold willingness to defend the Constitution is not going to be favored by many people. I think that's a mistake to think that that's not going to happen. And then you look at the polling that's been done of, for example, those who have signed on to impeachment campaigns. We have one of the impeachment campaigns that got off the ground right after the inauguration, when the president was refusing to divest fully from his business interests and violating the two anti-corruption provisions of the Constitution from the moment he took the oath of office. We launched with Roots Action, Impeach Donald Trump Now, .org. 1.4 million have since signed on. Tom Steyer, as we know, has a campaign, Need to Impeach. 5.5 million have signed on to that campaign, and they have actually surveyed those who've signed on to their campaign, and 60-plus percent 60-70% of those who have signed on to their campaign are infrequent voters. They actually don't often participate and go to the polls. So what does that tell us? It tells us that there are millions of people in this country, many more probably than even have learned of these petitions, who are willing to hear and wanting to hear the message of standing up for our Constitution, our democracy, and when they don't hear that, they may not even show up at the polls. So I think it's a mistake to look at this solely from the perspective of those who are, you know, the political strategists, the conventional political strategists calculate will show up, and rather look at this from the perspective of what's at stake for the Constitution and our democracy, and maybe actually that would broaden an electorate than we have now. But at the end of the day, if we put party over country, if we solely look at this from a political strategy perspective and ignore the constitutional dimension here, then we are setting a very, very dangerous precedent going forward for not just this administration, but for future administrations.
Well, just in the last minute, back to my concern that the Helsinki secret meeting between Trump and Putin were like two mob bosses meeting in secret, and we don't know what was discussed. We know that Trump is totally amoral, only cares about himself, is obviously from his manic tweeting about no collusion and witch hunt that he's obsessed with the Mueller investigation, which indicates, I think, that he's guilty. So if he and Putin basically worked out a deal that we'll basically, through cyber warfare and cyber meddling, we'll make the Democratic blue wave disappear. One, the Republicans would squeak by narrowly in an election that they lost by a landslide. There'd be enormous political disruption. It would make Florida 2000 look like a minor hiccup. And it served Putin's interests, which are to divide and demoralize Americans so that they lose faith in their democracy.
I don't think this scenario should be discounted. I share the concern, and I believe that, you know, we need to do much more to protect our elections going forward. As you may know, I've been involved in now two different presidential recounts, dealing both with the 2004 recount in Ohio and the 2016 presidential recounts. And, you know, in both of those instances, it's clear to me that we do not engage in verifying our elections, and that until we get to a place where we do actually randomly audit the process, ensure that those machine tallies are correct, get rid of the electronic voting machines that are defunct and do not properly serve as a means for accounting for the vote tallying process. Until we do that, then we're really going to be in a place where we're invulnerable to this kind of attack from the outside or from nefarious actors inside the United States. I share that concern, but I equally believe that we must be focused as well at the same time on what we're doing to deal with the current present day attack on our democracy and our Constitution. What you describe would be a humongous attack on our democracy and our Constitution on Election Day, but we've already been facing that attack from the moment this president assumed the oath of office, and it grows by the day. And, you know, even before this book went to print, we were looking at a ninth additional ground that we have since highlighted on our website at freespeechforpeople.org, which is the policy that the president oversaw to separate children from parents at the border, immigrants coming, fleeing persecution, to separate them in this cruel, inhumane way, but also in violation of their due process rights and their Eighth Amendment rights against cruel and unusual punishment. So we're dealing here with a situation that there will likely be many more grounds for impeachment proceedings before such proceedings actually begin. And that's all the more reason why we need to press for them to begin now and not look at this solely from the political dimension of who's up, who's down on the political equation.
Well, John Boniface, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you so so much. It's been an honor.
And again, I've been speaking with John Boniface, who's the co-founder and president of Free Speech for People, who previously served as executive director and general counsel of the National Voting Rights Institute and as the legal director of Voter Action. A distinguished attorney, he has been at the forefront of key voting rights battles across the country for more than two decades and is a winner of a MacArthur Foundation Fellowship Award. And he's the co-author of the new book just out, The Constitution Demands It, The Case for the Impeachment of Donald Trump. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into a shocking report from a grand jury investigation in Pennsylvania revealing that the Catholic Church in the state covered up child abuse by 301 priests over a 70-year period, identifying more than 1,000 victims. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Kenneth Briggs, who writes for the National Catholic Reporter. He's a professor at Lafayette College and a former New York Times religion editor, and is the author of Power of Forgiveness and Double Crossed, Uncovering the Catholic Church's Betrayal of American Nuns. And his latest book is the invisible bestseller, Searching for the Bible in America. Welcome to Background Briefing, Kenneth Briggs.
Thank you.
And every time we talk over the years, it's always about the same subject. And you'd think at some point or other these sex scandals in the Catholic Church would go away. But now we're learning from a grand jury report coming out of Pennsylvania of the most horrendous sexual abuse over a period of 70 years, more than 1,000 victims, I think, 301 priests are charged, or I don't exactly know what the legal term is or what their legal jeopardy is, but this is really...
Identified,
Identified, right. This is really shocking. So you've been covering this issue for a long time. How's it strike you?
It is striking by its massiveness. It portrays the church at a more seriously defective level than any batch of particular indictments or proven charges of molestation or abuse, which have been shocking over the years. But this is like a lead weight added to the whole mess, and it reveals it as a kind of congenital illness that goes to the very heart of the way the church has operated. And I think less shocking than destructive in a much more fundamental way, where the weight of this will not go away, I don't think anytime soon, and where it can't really be identified with the few bad apples approach. This is far more systemic and serious than that.
Well, in May, 31 bishops offered their resignation to the Pope, and so far, Pope Francis, I believe, has accepted the resignations of five. But the Australian Cardinal Pell, who was very senior in the Vatican in charge of finance, he's on trial in Australia, and it doesn't look very good for him.
No, and those are relatively localized situations. This takes in a big stake, and it interlocks the behavior of bishops primarily. This statement is most important for bishops because the pattern of cover up, excuse making, lying, is pervasive across the board. And the grand jury made no bones about it. They said basically there was a rule of thumb among the bishops that if cases of charges arose, then you adopted these evasive tactics to try to protect the church from harm. And they included all kinds of subterfuge. Now, that has been hinted at and pointed out in certain individual cases, certainly with Cardinal Waugh in Boston and McCarrick in Washington and a number of others. But this is connective tissue going on in Pennsylvania across a lot of border lines, across cross dioceses, and the pervasiveness and the density of it is, I think, something that is more deeply troubling, I would think, to dedicated Catholics than any single case or group of cases that have stood out up to now.
Well, some of the examples, though, in this grand jury report the Catholic Church's abuses in Pennsylvania catalogs some pretty nasty stuff. A priest raped a young girl in a hospital after she had her tonsils out, and another priest was allowed to stay in the ministry after impregnating a 17-year-old girl, forging a signature on a marriage certificate, and then divorcing the girl. So, I take it the Pope has his hands full. I mean, if you and I keep having to talk about this over the years and this issue doesn't go away, how do you think it feels to be Pope Francis?
Well, I think the Pope has been a little blind to a lot of this because I think it struck him as an incredible phenomenon that he couldn't quite wrap his head around. And I don't think it's so much dishonesty or depression on his part, perhaps. It's just waking up to the truth that even bishops and cardinals and popes end up being deceived by the mystique, if you will, of the church, to the kind of image that the church has sort of tried to put out about how its clergy behave and what they believe in. And I think the Pope pretty much has bought much of that the way they all do in the top rungs of the hierarchy. And I think it's been very much shocking to him that he has to actually come to terms with it. And the Chilean situation, where he did first just dismiss the case against a leading bishop there and then had to confront the truth of the matter, and he did. And he went back and he said, I'm sorry, I'm wrong, and then started accepting the resignation of bishops. I think generally stunned him and showed that in some areas he, of course, is not aware of things, or I don't think he's necessarily part of the problem, but he's become part of the problem. And now we'll see what happens. He's not a particularly activist pope who moves quickly to intervene or change direction. He deals more with words than he does with actions, but I think he is probably in a position now where he's got to have some sulking moments, wondering where the leadership of the church can come from these days if it's still imbued with that church's self-image of doing no wrong. And yet faced with this calamity. So it's really a matter of looking at the style of the church, the style of leadership. Now, he has been very forthright about saying he doesn't want bishops living like you know, earls and dukes and princes. But on the other hand, he hasn't gotten to this part of it where he has to face that they are leading, in many cases, lives of deception and malfeasance. And so where does a leader, what kind of leadership do you want, and where do you find it, even with the best intentions? Because you're promoting people who have been raised in that system, and there has been no great outbreak of protest against what's going on by bishops and clergy themselves. So if you're the Pope, where do you find the people who would lead the church in a new direction, rather than being defensive or continuing a pattern, believing that it's in the interests of the church to keep this under wraps and to keep things flowing along? Maybe now the public is alerted. Maybe Catholics in the pews are sufficiently upset to begin to push back. But so far, it really hasn't happened to much extent at all.
And you mentioned Chile. The police just raided the Catholic Church's headquarters in a part of their investigation into sexual abuse in the Catholic Church in Chile. But just in the last couple of minutes, is there any talk of structural problems? In other words, you know, this celibacy is obviously unrealistic, and it must be a part of the mix here in terms of why there's so much sexual abuse and pedophilia practiced by priests. Why not, you know, bite the bullet, allow priests to marry and ordain women?
Well, it would, of course, take a transformation of the culture of the church itself. And that's a huge undertaking, or a huge moment where it could happen, I suppose, from some. But basically, the same system is in order, and without some kind of dramatic reversal, the church still lives by a kind of self-justification of the clergy for what it does, and until you get to a point of honesty and what 12-step programs call, you know, hitting bottom and really realizing that you got to really get honest and go. And I don't know how it can happen with a few cosmetic changes, but, you know, some things I suppose would help. And of course, changing celibacy, I think, would. But the Pope seems unable to do it. So that's where we are now, I think.
Well, Kenneth Briggs, I thank you. I hope next time we talk, it's about something else. But I thank you. I thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much, and best wishes.
And again, I've been speaking with Kenneth Briggs, who writes for the National Catholic Reporter. He's a professor at Lafayette College and a former New York Times religion editor, and is the author of Power of Forgiveness and Double Crossed, Uncovering the Catholic Church's Betrayal of American Nuns. And his latest book is the invisible bestseller, Searching for the Bible in America. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.